This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. So, the big day is here for the Red Sox and their fans. Game 6 of the World Series, with Boston holding a 3-2 advantage over the St. Louis Cardinals. A chance to win it all at Fenway Park for the first time since 1918.
In a moment, Only a Game's Bill Littlefield and Red Sox historian Glenn Stout will join us to look back at World Series history and to look forward to tonight's game and a possible Game 7. And listeners, we want to hear from you. What do you make of this year's Fall Classic, which has the Red Sox so close to a third World Series victory in the past 9 years? Where are you sitting for tonight's game? Above the Green Monster? In the bleachers? At your local watering hole, or maybe on your couch at home? Give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston.
But first, let's talk a little bit about what the World Series means to the local economy. And we'll talk about baseball, listeners. I promise. But we got to do some money talk. Because for anyone waiting tables in Kenmore Square.
Or hawking hats outside of Fenway.
Or driving a taxi in the city. And you'll understand that the benefits of October baseball go much further than the rush of excitement that you get from watching the Sox on TV. The World Series, in fact, pumps a lot of money into the local economy.
There are big costs, too, including police overtime, traffic tie-ups, and cleaning up the mess when it's all over. Big time sports events like the World Series make for complicated accounting.
So joining us now to talk more about this is Callum Borchers, who writes about the crowded intersection of government, business, and sports for the Boston Globe. Hi there, Callum.
Always a pleasure and extra fun on a day like today.
All right, so give us the number. How much money does the World Series inject into the local economy?
Well, the Greater Boston Convention and Visitors Bureau puts it at about $6 million per game, and even more so for the Game 6 and 7. We're talking maybe $6.3 million, so it's quite a lot of money, and it's spread out quite far, actually, not just those bars and restaurants that we, of course, think of first.
So do you have faith in that number? I mean, because the convention center, they do a good job, but does it seem accurate to you?
It seems like a reasonable estimate, especially when you consider that his counterpart in St. Louis put the number at about $9 million in that city. And part of that is just because of the size of that stadium. They can hold many more fans, so more fans coming there, spending more and whatnot. So in some ways, perhaps it's a conservative figure when you consider the zeal that we have for our Red Sox here in the city.
Okay. So, as Anthony and I mentioned a minute or two ago, everything from restaurants to taxis to things like that, do the games get more valuable for the local economy as we sort of go through the series, closer and closer to a Game 7, for example?
Exactly, they do. If you go back to the ALCS, for instance, the Visitors Bureau said, well, we're talking, maybe $3 million per game. And then, first couple games of the World Series, maybe 5.7. And then, Game 6 and 7, 6.3. Obviously the Sox have won a couple series recently, but this is the first time in 95 years that they can clinch at home, which just sort of has that extra sparkle to it. The idea that fans can actually spill out of Fenway Park, and go then and celebrate right here in Boston, I think adds a little extra something special.
Mm, except if you want to walk through Kenmore Square, for example, after the sixth inning, I'm hearing that you have to walk around it because they're going to sort of close down parts of Kenmore Square for security reasons. And that leads me to ask about the costs. I mean, we've been talking about the benefits to the local economy, but, all those additional police officers and safety procedures, they come at a cost to the local economy.
They surely do, and I wish I could tell you exactly what that number is. I put the question this morning to the Boston police and said, could you ballpark what you think the cost will be, for instance, just for the police detail for tonight? No response just yet, unfortunately. But we could imagine that it was going to be an expensive day anyway because, of course, the president is in town. There's a lot going on in the city. And then, of course, if they happen to win, what will it cost for the parade and whatnot? Hopefully it won't counteract the full $6 million benefit per game, right? But surely it comes at a high price.
I eagerly anticipate your follow-up reporting on this, Callum. But finally, let's talk about some vendors around the park. They've got to be doing really well with all the excitement.
They are. And like I say, some of them are obvious ones. So my colleague Megan Woolhouse had a great piece today about Eastern Standard, for instance. And of course, for the business, it's very good. But also for the individuals, the waiters and waitresses there and the busboys, picking up extra tips. And I talk about that ripple effect, right? So, she met one waitress, for instance, who said, she's pocketed about an extra $100 a night in tips. And what are you planning to do with that money? And she said, well, I think that I'll maybe go on a little spending spree at my favorite Boston store. So, it sort of carries over, right? And then you consider beyond that immediate radius for the ballpark. The Duck Tour is telling me that, hey, you know, we're getting extra folks coming because you're looking for activities to do before the first pitch. And even the USS Constitution, right? You know, the director over there saying, you know, there's something about the national pastime that really brings out your appreciation of American history. You know, so like last Saturday, for instance, for Game 6 of the ALCS, their visitorship was up 56% in just one day, which, by the way, is a big help because they had to close down with the government shutdown. Right. So this is helping them lick their wounds a little bit.
Not to say that we're calling the Cardinals the Redcoats of 2013, though. Well, Callum Borchers covers business, government, and sports for the Boston Globe. Callum, always great to have you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And so here we go, on to Game 6 tonight at Fenway Park. Huge deal to the Red Sox, their fans, and to an entire region. So we're going to spend a little time now talking about the significance of it all and about some recent and distant Red Sox World Series history. Joining us in the studio is Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Hey, Bill, good to have you here.
It's good to be here, as always, Anthony.
Also with us is writer Glenn Stout. He's a writer, Red Sox historian, and author of Fenway 1912. And Glenn, great to have you back on the program.
Great to be here. Thanks, everybody.
And listeners, this is your chance to chime in this sort of roundtable discussion around the excitement of tonight's game and to look back at some World Series history. Where are you watching tonight's game? At Fenway? Are you one of the lucky, 36,000? Are you at home? What do you make of this year's Fall Classic? And how does it compare with past World Series in which the Red Sox have prevailed or failed? Call us at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Okay, Bill, Glenn, as has been reported again and again, the Red Sox won a World Series at Fenway Park in 1918. They beat the Chicago Cubs in six games. That's the last time a World Series celebration took place in Fenway. Glenn, tell us something about that game, which was played amidst a certain amount of controversy, right?
Right, right. During that World Series, in fact, before Game 5 of the World Series, the players on the Cubs and the Red Sox nearly went on strike because the people that ran baseball had changed the way World Series money was going to be distributed. This was in the middle of World War I, so the fans were quite dismayed at the delay and started yelling Bolsheviki and other epithets at the players, calling them slackers for not participating in the military. So by the time Game 6 rolled around, they'd pretty much had it, and there were only about 17,000 people in Fenway Park for Game 6. So it was very much a subdued celebration, although what I do think is interesting is after the Red Sox won, they did release carrier pigeons to inform the soldiers at Fort Devens.
Oh, boy. But it's amazing to imagine. The Fenway Park wasn't even full. Hard to imagine that today. Was that considered unusual at the time?
It sort of was, but at the same token, the entire season of 1918, because of the war, it was truncated because of the war. There wasn't a great deal of excitement or enthusiasm. So when the World Series wasn't very exciting, and it wasn't a very exciting World Series, the lowest scoring one of all time, people were already sort of looking forward to next year.
Hmm. Glenn, let me ask you one more question about sort of the deep sort of World Series history here in Boston. The Boston Americans, as the Red Sox were known, or as the team was known then, won a lot. They won in 1903, 1912, 15, 16, and then, of course, 1918. What explained their dominance back then?
Well, it was sort of a setup from the beginning. When Ben Johnson started the American League, he put a team in Boston to go head-to-head against the Boston National League team, which had been a real powerhouse in the 1890s, and he wanted a good team in Boston, and he sort of set things up so that there was going to be a good team in Boston. They won in 1903. They had another great season in 1904. Fell on hard times a little bit after that, but then the Taylor family took over. They were very well funded. You know, this was a center of baseball. Most of the players back then came from New England, so it was very easy for a team in Boston to continue to get good players and to continue to be competitive.
Hmm. Well, let's move on to another bit of history that tonight's game recalls. This is more recent history. The last time the Red Sox played a World Series Game 6 at Fenway, this happened.
There it goes, a long drive. if it stays fair, home run.
And of course, Bill, that's Carlton Fisk tying the series at 3 games apiece with the Reds in 1975. What do you recall about that great Game 6 in 1975?
Well, the interesting thing about that call is if you listen very carefully, you can hear Carlton Fisk pushing the ball fair around the foul pole in left field.
I could feel it in my ears.
You have to listen very carefully. That was a great moment, and it's one of the great visual images for baseball fans and sports fans in general in New England, Fisk dancing down the first baseline, willing the ball into fair territory, and one of many images from that year. Of course, the thing that people remember who were actively watching and listening to the Red Sox at that point more than anything else, I think, is the incredible final month of the season that Carl Yastrzemski had, where he hit roughly over the course of a month what David Ortiz is hitting in the World Series this year, which is about 730 or something like that. My favorite story about that, of course, is that when people were getting ready to go into the tunnel, the Callahan Tunnel, if Yastrzemski was coming up to bat, they stopped and wouldn't go into the tunnel because they would lose the radio call when they went into the tunnel.
As if traffic wasn't a problem.
Probably not quite as bad a problem in 1967, but bad enough, I'm sure, that it caused quite a congestion.
And Glenn, what about that Game 6 in 1975? Do you recall where you were?
Oh, I was at home in Ohio at that time. I was still in high school, but I think one of the real interesting things about that World Series is the way that it introduced Fenway Park to the rest of the country, because you got to see Fenway Park in contrast to Cincinnati's horrible Riverfront Stadium, and with Fisk's home run, everything that was special about Fenway Park seemed to be shown all at once. You got to see the Green Monster, you got to see the fans, you got to see all these great camera angles, and baseball was clearly different in Fenway Park than it was anywhere else. And I think from that moment on is really when the country at large, and even in Boston to some extent, started to look around and say, hey, this is a really special place. Baseball is different here than anywhere else in the country.
Just a minute, Anthony, before all of your callers light up the lines to say what an idiot I am. I was confused. I was, of course, so excited about what you had played that I was confusing 67 and Carl Yastrzemski's magical month in 67.
That's okay. 67 certainly.
75. It was all a long time ago, and they didn't win the World Series in those days, so who cares?
You were just free associated with great moments.
Basically, I was, and I think it's that was what people had until 2004. They had these wonderful images of great moments, great images, without the kind of pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. And, of course, 2004 changed all that.
Listeners, we're talking to Bill Littlefield and Glenn Stout about some World Series history here in Boston on the day that the Red Sox are going to meet the St. Louis Cardinals at Game 6 in the World Series. Give us your call. Ask your question about World Series history or tell us what you recall about some World Series history here in Boston. 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Dan Shaughnessy wrote today in the Globe and made the point that Game 6s can be great. They can also be heartbreakers. We just heard a clip of tape from that great home run by Fisk in 1975. Glenn Stout, then of course there was Game 6 in 1986, which went very much the other way, right? The Red Sox one strike away and the grounder through the legs of Bill Buckner. Yeah.
Yeah, no question about it. I mean, there is that great symmetry of Game 6s in Red Sox history. But, of course, the thing that defines both those years is that the Red Sox ultimately lost. And, you know, if you look at this year, it is another Game 6. And if the Red Sox end up losing, I hope that this Game 6 doesn't get lumped in with those other two Game 6s. Because I think there's such anticipation right now. There's a lot of people who are really ready to cheer and celebrate, and you want to temper that just a little bit because you don't want to get ahead of yourselves. Game 6s have had a strange history with this team, so be a little cautious, going into tonight. Save a couple of those beers for the end of the game. Don't waste it all before the ninth inning, I think.
I think you raise a great point, and Bill, I want to hear you on this. I'm sensing out there downright cockiness in great contrast to the old days when there was always this sense of they'll figure out a way how to lose it. Now I think we're in the other extreme. There's this sort of cockiness. We're going to win it.
I think you're right. And I think that that comes partly from the fact, obviously, that they won in 2004 and again in 2007. Yeah. There's a whole generation of fans who don't understand why anybody ever saw the Red Sox as doomed. And those of us of a certain age, of course, do understand that. To me, the interesting thing when a series goes this far to six games, potentially to seven games, is all the different currents that you get to follow. I mean, for example, everybody's talking about David Ortiz. Is this finally going to be the night that some other guys in Red Sox uniforms get some hits? Everybody talks about Waka. What a wonderful performance he's put
on so
far,
right?
The St. Louis pitcher. Is this the night when the Red Sox finally figure out that if they wait on his changeup, they can hit his fastball? I don't know, but all of these things, they don't happen in a World Series that ends after only four games, and that, of course, is what happened in 2004 and again in 2007 when the Red Sox were champions. The other team didn't stick around long enough to develop any stories with interesting bumps and corners.
Glenn, Bill always talks about, he roots for the story. What's the story you're rooting for? I mean, I know you're a Red Sox fan. I know you want them to win, but what's the story within that story that's sort of most intriguing to you?
Well, I'm not really a Red Sox fan. I'm a baseball fan, but the story I'm really rooting for, just because it's out there like a hanging curveball, is for this to end after Game 7. It's going to be Halloween. Everybody's going to be wearing beards. The Red Sox could walk out of the stadium after winning in Game 7 in their beards and be completely unidentifiable because they'll be amidst 50,000 people who are also wearing beards. So I'm holding out for the Halloween World Series ending this year.
So now there you are again with that, dare I say, a little bit of cockiness that if they lose tonight, of course they're going to win Game 7. If they lose tonight, I'd be petrified that they would not win Game 7.
I'm with you,
well,
Anthony.
There is that nightmare Halloween scenario, too.
Exactly. I'm with you. I want them to win it tonight. I usually root for a Game 7 because Game 7 is always an intriguing sort of story, but I got to root for him to win tonight. It's getting cold. It's going to be wet tomorrow. I'm rooting for him to put it away.
The Boston Police are rooting for a Game 6 ending tonight, too.
I'm sure they are.
I need some sleep, so I'm rooting for them to win tonight as well. Listeners, 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to William, who's calling from Epping, New Hampshire. Hi, William. You're on the air.
Hi. The story I remember from 2004 was about the 1916 left fielder, Duffy Lewis, back when there was no Green Monster, and the berm out there in left field was referred to as Duffy's Cliff. Mr. Lewis was had no children and wound up in an unmarked grave in Londonderry, New Hampshire, in the Catholic cemetery. A reporter for the Lawrence Eagle Tribune, I believe, discovered this during the 2004 run to the World Series. A columnist for the Manchester Union Leader, the New Hampshire statewide paper, picked it up. And very soon there was a beautiful stone with an engraving of Fenway Park with no left field wall over Mr. Lewis.
Hmm. That's a nice story. William, thanks so much for that call. Glenn, left fielder Duffy Lewis from the 1916 team. Can you add something to William's?
Oh, he was terrific, and he is the reason why it's called, why that embankment out there was called Duffy's Cliff, because he was so adept at running up and down it to field balls. Another funny story that came from 1918 is because of that player strike, Major League Baseball refused to give the players of that team their World Series medallions, which is the equivalent of today's World Series rings. And it wasn't until 1993 that Major League Baseball finally decided that they would award the descendants of the 1918 team their World Series medallions because of that strike back in 1918. So you see how the World Series coming up again and again, you know, it can lead to good things happening, things that have been forgotten being recalled once again.
Hmm. Let's take another call. George is calling from Maynard. Hi, George, you're on the air.
Oh, hi there. I just wanted to give Bill Buckner his due, because we always seem to be rewriting the history of what really happened in 1986, and it wasn't one strike away. It was already tied at that point, and it rolled through Bill's legs. And it we probably would have lost anyway.
Well, it's true. You make a good point. The winning run went through. I mean, the ball went through his legs and allowed the winning run. And but you're right. The Red Sox were one strike away, and then the game was tied. But Bill Buckner, I think, has been somewhat redeemed. He's been back to Fenway Park. He can now sort of joke about it. I interviewed him last year and was really impressed with what a sort of soulful, thoughtful, lovely guy he is. What do you think, Glenn Stout, about George's call?
Well, I think now that the Red Sox have won a couple of titles, you know, all the bad karma from 86 and 75 and the GOATs, you know, Johnny Pesky holding the ball and all that sort of nonsense, that's sort of been cast into the dustbin of history now. That's how things used to be. You know, now things are different. Now, for lack of a better metaphor, the Red Sox are the Yankees. They're the team that everybody expects to win. They're the team that fans in other cities look to as being the team that's really cocky, that's really, you know, doing it with money. So, you know, things have changed dramatically. And as Bill said, you know, if you're a kid, if you're like under the age of 20, all you've ever known is the Red Sox being a great team. And you hear stories like this and you think, oh, what are those old coots talking about?
But don't you think, and I'll ask both of you, and Bill, you answer this first. I mean, don't you think that if they lose tonight and went on to win a game seven, that ability to this region to summon those old ghosts of, we knew this would happen, they'd be there, they'd be back in a second.
I'm not sure that that's really true.
Really?
I'm thinking because the Cardinals are the opponent this time around, think back to the World Series that the Cardinals fairly recently lost to the Red Sox. They lost in four straight games.
Yep.
Were people in St. Louis saying, oh, the Cardinals are terrible? No, they were saying, hey, the Cardinals got to the World Series. The Cardinals are annually an admirably run and very successful ball club. That's their history. I don't think it doesn't change if you lose one. I think the only way that the circumstance that you are talking about might come to pass is if they lose in some spectacularly macabre way. And, of course, the Red Sox historically have been capable of losing in a spectacularly macabre way. Somebody falls down, Louis Aparicio running around third base, or Johnny Pesky allegedly holds the ball, which I don't believe he did, or Carl Yastrzemski pops up, or Bob Stanley throws a wild pitch, or either that or Rich Gedman, you know, commits a pass ball, et cetera, et cetera.
There's so many ways for it to go wrong.
Unless there's a, but, you know, here, that's interesting. This time around, you got that crazy call, not crazy, but unusual call in game three that basically enabled St. Louis to win, the interference call. It was the correct call, at least as far as I can determine. Did a whole lot of Red Sox fans immediately put their faces in their hands and say, oh, here we go again? No, we're not. Well, the players certainly didn't. They went on to win two games in St. Louis. So I'm inclined to think that we're beyond that. And I hope that I haven't jinxed them forever by saying so.
All right, let's take one more call at least. Erica from Hollis, New Hampshire. Hi, Erica. You're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to, this isn't so much a memory, but in listening to the coverage, I would like to hear more about Koji Uehara and just about how he sort of is an accidental closer and how well he's done and how he wasn't even really a pitcher, I don't think, until later in his career.
Well, it's a great question. I mean, Koji Uehara, of course, one of the big, big, big stories. Hard to imagine the Red Sox being where they are without him. Glenn Stout, what do we know about sort of where he came from? We know he wasn't the closer when the season started.
Well, yeah, I mean, she's right. He is a big surprise. And that's what's intriguing about this entire team, is that so many of the players on this team are something of a surprise. You know, no one expected this team to be anywhere close to the World Series unless they were going to be watching it, you know, on their own couches at home. But yet, you know, that's what's exciting about this kind of season, is you have people like Uehara kind of coming out of nowhere. Fans get invested in certain players over the course of a season, and they become their team in the same way that some fans were invested in the 67 team or the 75 team or the 86 team. And that's what makes, you know, World Series and series like this so great is you're watching not just the Red Sox, you're watching your Red Sox. And performances by guys like Uehara are the reason that's the case.
You know, another point, and Bill and I were chatting a little bit about this before the show, that, this World Series comes amidst a really phenomenal run of success among all of Boston sports teams. I mean, over the past decade, we've seen two World Series titles, Super Bowl wins, an NBA championship, of course, almost two Stanley Cups, which raises the question, and Bill, you know, historically this city has embraced the Red Sox as the favorite team. Is that changing? Might that change?
It has been true that historically, if you said to somebody, hey, talk to me about Boston as a sports town, the Red Sox would be the first team that they would talk about, no question about it. I think the NFL has become such a monster in the American cultural scene. So many people so heavily invested in their NFL teams that probably in terms of numbers, the Patriots have become something of a larger deal here than the Red Sox. But not today.
What do you think, Glenn?
Well, I agree with Bill to an extent, but, you know, it's the New England Patriots. They're not the Boston Patriots anymore. And I think when people think of Boston, they don't think of the Patriots right away as much as they do the Red Sox. And most certainly, Fenway Park. No one thinks about Gillette Stadium as being this iconic symbol of a region and a city. You know, it's an iconic symbol of a lot of things, but it's not that. Whereas Fenway Park is something that's inherently Boston. People come here from China and they say, "What do you want to go see?" They don't say anything else but Fenway Park. That might be the only two words of English they know, but Fenway Park is the place they want to see.
Well, here we go. We're just, 4 hours and a few minutes away from the first pitch of Game 6 of the World Series, St. Louis Cardinals against the Boston Red Sox. Glenn Stout, a longtime baseball writer, author of Fenway 1912, The Birth of a Ballpark, A Championship Season, and Fenway's Remarkable Year. Glenn, always a pleasure to have you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
I did too. And Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. As always, Bill, many thanks for coming in.
You're very welcome, Anthony. Thank you.
And stay with us. Coming up, we'll be heading to Faneuil Hall for President Obama's speech on the Affordable Care Act. That's coming up. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.